From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At noon today, the bells of Big Ben chimed 12 mournful times over London. Millions observed the 2 minutes of silence that followed across the UK. Cars and buses in the country's capital stopped in remembrance of last week's bloody terrorist attacks. Globally, the prevalence of terrorism is mounting. And whether we realize it or not, we are adapting to that fact, psychologically and socially. Some countries, sadly, have a lot of experience already. Israel, the UK itself, with its IRA experience and memories of the Blitz. Post-9/11, the United States has begun its own journey of adaptation, absorbing the reality of attacks at home and abroad. Tonight on Point, the psychology of terror and how societies respond to man-made disasters. You can join the conversation. How do you see American culture responding and adapting to the era of terror? Are there good responses and bad responses? How are we doing? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New Brunswick, New Jersey, is Lee Clark. He's a sociologist at Rutgers University and a leading researcher in the field of disaster studies. He's investigated calamities and how societies respond to them for many years. His new book, Worst Cases, will be published this fall. Lee Clark, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you. Welcome.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Clark.
Lee Clark, your thoughts over this week since the London attacks on how Britishers, but also Americans, are responding this time to an attack which, while not close to home, seems close culturally, and of course through the media, everything comes close.
No, it's of course a tragic week, but in America, the key response has been, of course, when is it going to happen to us? The jokes are made about this as if we were just concerned only with ourselves. I don't think that's true. I think it's a legitimate question. Many of us have wondered why we haven't been hit by suicide bombers already. So we talk sometimes about how we are adapting to the threat of terrorism, and I think that's not an inaccurate way to put it, but it's not whole enough. It's not full enough. We're remarkably resilient. What's had to happen in America since 9/11 is that we've had to build sort of a cognitive folder for these kinds of events, whereas I think most of us did not have that folder before.
And is that a good thing? Is becoming inoculated to terrorism, building a kind of ready resilience, important? Or is it a...
If you think that we're... safe from any further risk, which most Americans don't think, mm-hmm. I don't think, then it would be a bad thing. If you think that that it's only a matter of time before somebody goes into our subways or does something even worse, then I think it's a good thing. It's not that we become inoculated or inured, but if the threat is there, to not face up to it seems to me the height of irresponsibility.
You are considered a kind of founding father in this new discipline in sociology, disaster studies, looking not just at terrorism, but earthquakes and fires and floods, big bad things that happen. Are there common patterns of social response to these?
There are a lot of patterns, but let me say first, the reason that we know that there are a lot of patterns is that, in fact, this kind of research has been going on for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm old, but I'm not old enough to be a founding father.
Okay, fair enough.
The research really started with the Strategic Bombing Survey after and during, I suppose, World War II. There are a bunch of patterns. One of them is that we know that the kind of panic that we see in disaster movies mm-hmm. is quite rare.
The sort of War of the Worlds, people screaming through the streets.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness that it shows that it looks like that in Hollywood movies, because otherwise it would be much less entertaining. But if they were to show how people really respond, they would be documentaries. It's not that people don't scream and become frightened. They do. Reading the testimony of the survivors in the tube and from the bus and from the streets of London, same pattern we see came out there that we saw at World Trade Center, that we see in fires, earthquakes, and big bad things, as you put it. And what happens is people come out of those events and they say, oh my God, there was panic everywhere, and we were frightened out of our pants. Sometimes they use more colorful language. Mm-hmm. Then you push, and you say, well, what did you actually do? And sometimes you get journalists who really do push like
right.
that. Well, tell us about it. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there was this chair was knocked over on this old lady, and I just had to help her out. Well, did you know that old lady? No, but it just was the right thing to do. There's this distinction between how people feel and how they behave. And they often feel terrorized, utterly horrified, out of their minds, but their behavior is often quite different.
And there's that first inner circle of response to terror, and you say it's not that sort of wild-eyed, stampeding panic that's depicted by Hollywood, but something more attentive and caring to people around them. And then it all ripples out from miles and miles and miles across years we now see. Jack Beattie, I wonder, same to you, your thoughts in this week since London. Here we go again, not on the scale of 9/11, but horrible, shocking terror attacks, and all the worse because it's suicide and bombers deep under the earth. How do you see, we can't speak for everyone here, the British have their own way of responding, and we'll talk about that tonight, but how about Americans this time on from 9/11? How do you see the culture absorbing this new threat, this era?
Well, one way, in the Boston subway, just this week, a voice now, as you're waiting for the train, a voice now comes on the loudspeaker system saying, now more than ever, watch out for strange doings and people and packages. Mm. And if you hear that two or three times waiting for the train, something happens to you, and that is that you engage in what the psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, who studied Hiroshima survivors, called psychic numbing. You gotta, in order to function. And in individuals, psychic numbing, turning things off, leads to depression. That's sort of what it is. It's depression as a defense mechanism against fear and trauma. And I think something like that may be true of, certainly it's true of urban dwellers in America today, that there's a kind of low-level psychic numbing social depression, if you will, as a way of handling this. It's an adaptation, but it's at the individual level and at the social level, it's perhaps not the most creative one. For example, one could imagine simply a mass movement of people in cities who could have gone to Washington just today and said, no, the Senate voted down a Democratic amendment to put $1 billion into what? Locks, dogs, cameras, other things just for urban transit systems. Senate voted it down. Well, I mean, a positive way of dealing with that fear is to say to those senators, no, we can't have that. We need the, and it was just $1 billion. Mm-hmm. And Senator Gregg, the Budget Committee chairman, said, no, we don't want to do that. We're fighting terrorists in Iraq. And of course, urban dwellers should say, well, wait a minute, do we want to fight them in Iraq or do we want our subways safe?
Lee Clark, a couple of things there that seem to intersect with what I've read from your work. One, what about Jack's notion of psychic numbing and social depression? But as we confront the potential enormity of disasters, of terrorist disasters, you say people should confront this.
What I'm saying is that people should have information about the threats that they face. And what Jack says rings true, and there are cases certainly where that happens. But it's not really showing up in the survey data very well. People are concerned about terrorist attacks. The concern went up after last week's, I'm talking about Americans, concern went up after July 7, but still the numbers are lower than they were in October of 2001. Mm-hmm. When the polls ask people what is their estimation that they themselves or their families are going to suffer a terrorist attack, the numbers have basically not changed since right after September 11. Although, I should quickly add, the numbers that I saw on that did not include July 7. Depression, the numbers, especially, well, these numbers are more anecdotal to me. In New York, I've seen some horrific studies about people and depression there, especially in lower Manhattan.
In the immediate aftermath or even now, going on
even
4 years later?
Even now, people who feel that their concerns were not addressed, that they're, for example, there are a lot of people still deeply concerned about the asbestos and other stuff that was flying around.
Yep.
When all the public health officials at the time were saying, don't worry about that, everything's fine. Well, it wasn't, and they felt like their interests weren't taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
So what Jack says is a real phenomenon. I'm not sure how deeply it permeates the culture.
You write that the usual view in the United States is that because we are a richer country, we feel buffered from disaster.
We are. It's a kind of a paradox of richness. We're rich in rich societies. People live longer and they live better. This is generally not because of high-tech medicine, but mainly because we can keep animals from defecating in the streets. We have clean water. We have better nutrition.
Public health. Mm-hmm.
Right. But as we live longer, so do our expectations rise. And we also come to expect that our government, that somebody is responsible for almost any calamity or any damage that might come our way.
And we see that there are some things that are pretty hard to guard against, though terrorism is not quite the same as a flood, let's say. Lee Clark, please stand by. Jack Beatty, we're talking tonight, 1 week after the London attacks, about the psychology of terror, how societies respond to man-made disaster. How do you see American culture responding to adapting to the era of terror? Are there good responses and bad responses? How are we doing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. By Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And by Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, print, and interactive communication solutions. Thoughtful design embedded in creative strategy. CMNDesign.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the psychology of terror, how societies respond to man-made disaster. You can join us tonight. Can you feel a difference between your personal response and American society's response as you perceive it? How do you see terrorism's long-term imprint on this country, on this culture, shaping up? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty's with us tonight, and we're joined from New Brunswick, New Jersey, by Lee Clark, sociologist at Rutgers University, author of the forthcoming book, Worst Cases. We're joined now as well from Tucson, Arizona, by Jeff Greenberg. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of Arizona. He's co-author of In the Wake of 9/11, The Psychology of Terror. Jeff Greenberg, thank you for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
I wonder your thoughts. You wrote soon after 9/11 about its impact. Now, here we are some time later. You wrote about how terrorism is a brutal reminder of life's fragility, and that has many implications for individual and social psychology. How do you see the American response over time shaping up in psychological terms?
What terrorism is ultimately about is dealing out death. And that resonates with the sense of vulnerability that we all carry with us. As Lee pointed out, terrorism and disaster is just one kind of threat that we have in society. I mean, there's cancer, there's homicide, there's car fatalities. And we have to cope with the reality, the knowledge of all of these possible threats. And I believe Lee is correct that before 9/11, Americans didn't think too much about terrorism as a deep source of personal threat. Since 9/11, we do think of it that way. And I think it has become another kind of threat that we have to find ways to cope with.
And do you see it changing, Americans as individuals, America as a culture, or are we just somehow taking it on board within the context that we carried before 9/11 in psychological terms? Do you see a deep imprint here or not?
Well, I think there was definitely a deeper imprint from 9/11. That's quite clear when you think about the Patriot Act, when you think about the military actions in Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq. All of these things are, in large part, long-term consequences of the attacks of 9/11.
Let me just ask you there. Do you see those as strategic responses, or do you interpret those as psychological responses somehow?
Well, I think they're both. I think that a lot of the support for them among kind of everyday people is because it's psychologically comforting, that when we feel that we're under threat, we want to feel that there's something we can do about it, and we want to find these sources of evil, these things that are scaring us, and try to eradicate them. And so we look to our leaders to find answers. And I think the simplest answer is to go on the offense and find the evildoers and try to get justice out of it. And I think that President Bush has very effectively sold that message to the American people. And in light of the London attacks, he just kind of reiterated that view.
Now, we know the debate over that in strategic terms. In psychological terms, how do you see that response? Is that a healthy response, a productive response?
Well, I think it serves the individual's psychological equanimity, but it can be at the cost of those whom we designate as sources of evil that are worth killing. So it's sort of that's a political issue. It depends on whether you think the attacks on the Taliban and the invasion of Iraq, whether the people who were killed and damaged by those things were legitimate sources of the sorts of evils that we'd like to eradicate. I personally don't think so.
But psychology and politics riding very close there. I want to begin to bring our callers in. A lot of them want to join this conversation. Trina is calling from Rutherford, New Jersey. Trina, what do you know? What do you think?
I'm sorry, it's Karina, but thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was actually in Manhattan during September 11th, so I guess I'm calling in as an urban dweller. I guess I have 2 points. One is that I think that a lot of people that have to deal with these terror attacks directly are forced to work through the stages of grieving. For example, I honestly felt after September 11th that a lot of America was heavily within denial, and that kind of couched their reaction to Afghanistan and to Iraq. And that might also explain Caro's comments about liberals wanting to give the terrorists hugs also. But my other point is that during the London terror attacks, the day afterwards, I have a lot of friends that I just know who were very upset by them. But at the same time, in my professional world, my work friends and the people that I know around me in my community, they were really not affected at all. And that really upset me, because
it upset you because you saw terror with them on 9/11, and now they weren't responding to what was in London, or why?
Well, I'm in a different career right now, so I'm not with the same people that I had been. But it upset me because I remembered the way London had reached out to the New Yorkers, and I didn't see that. I mean, granted, I'm not living in Manhattan right now, so perhaps there was a large outreach there. But in the New Jersey communities, which I know were really affected, some communities here lost quite a few people in September 11th. I didn't really see that kind of outreach, and I'm not sure if we're inoculated or if we are just, callous Americans that didn't think about people on the other side of the pond.
Karina, we've got it. We appreciate your call. Lee Clark, what do you say to that observation? Karina wanted to see more response from the Americans around her to what happened in London. How do you interpret? You describe people responding in very fulsome way when they're right next to a disaster, diving in to help almost without exception. Here across the pond, is it different?
Hi, my experience was different from Trina's. I saw not massive outpouring of grief, but I saw a lot of concern on the part of Americans. It matters. The body count matters. I hate to sound cold and calculating about it, but when we saw what could have been tens of thousands of people could have been killed in the World Trade Center, that affects people in a different way than I don't want to sound cold, but more than 50 people die in airplane crashes nearly every day. So my experience was different than Trina's, so I'm not disagreeing or countering what she said, but I saw more outpourings of sympathy than
that. But you're saying at the same time scale matters. We're not so shaken by what happened in London because it's not the same as if it had been a nuclear reactor somewhere and thousands or tens of thousands killed. I mean,
or a nuclear explosion in the heart of London. I think it would have been quite, would have been different then.
Jack, my sense is that we're, for all the kind of peripheral, I don't know, self-congratulation for dealing with this last week so well, it seems to me we're all still vulnerable to that overwhelming disaster that once again shakes our sense of fundamental security in the world.
There's no question about it. I mean, people who've looked at the Homeland Security Program, I mean, we've talked about it on our show, of the gaps in it, the gaps in chemical plants, nuclear plants, you know, the gaps in terms of looking at the cargoes coming into our ports, our subways. In all of these ways, we are probably not as vulnerable as before September 11th, but still nowhere near where you would think the public would have demanded we should be. And that's the part of it that puzzles me, that that the public hasn't demanded more of this, that somehow the magic of the phrase Homeland Security Department, a big bureaucracy that can't get out of its own way, has allayed the fears that and the almost the politics of fear alleviation that I thought was going to just sweep the country. But I see now that there's been a kind of suburban detachment from it. This is something city dwellers have to worry about. This isn't going to bother me up here in rustic New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think there's that kind of opting out. And I think it's reflected in this vote today in the Senate, where every Republican member voted against this $1 billion for subways. And, you know, when you thought about it, very few of those senators represent areas that have subways.
So there's a very kind of careful parsing of where vulnerability lies and if is it my vulnerability or someone else's.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh. Kevin's calling from Boston. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a psychologist, and mm-hmm. my specialty is psychological trauma. For the last 20 years, and I'd just like to hear from your guests what they think about the idea of municipalities and state and even federal government really developing plans and strategies for psychological resilience, much the way we do for developing emergency response programs and crisis management recovery systems.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. Lee Clark, let me turn to you. I know you use this phrase preemptive resilience, and I don't know if you see that in terms of psychological or logistical resilience.
Sure. First of all, let me say that I agree with all those criticisms that Jack just leveled against Department of Homeland Security and our inattentiveness to these major risks. What I think, to answer the caller's question or address it directly, is I think that psychological resilience will flow from being more prepared at the local level. Let me give you an example. We know that roughly 20% of Americans are in K through 12, roughly half the year.
Right.
If I live in central New Jersey, some of us have some reason to worry about a chemical attack or an attack on a chemical plant around here.
Mm-hmm.
Should something horrific like that happen, probably the best thing for everybody to do is to shelter in place. Okay, so I need to know as a parent that my kids are going to be safe.
Otherwise, you're going to be running to the school when you shouldn't be.
That's right, because another one of those patterns that you asked me about from disaster research is that people respond to disaster, including terror attacks, in terms of familial units. Now, what happens immediately in this kind of situation is that the first grade teacher becomes a first responder. Mm-hmm. We don't usually think of them in that way.
Not a fireman or a policeman, but the person who's on the scene when it happens.
The fact is that most, and this takes nothing away from the firefighters or the police. I like them. I think we need more training and more resources for them, all of that. But the fact is that most people who are going to die in a disaster die before those people, the official responders, get to the scene. That means if we prepare at the very local level, workplace, schools, faith-based organizations, if we prepare there, giving people the resources that they need to have some confidence that they do control their environment, that will give them that psychological resiliency that the caller asked about.
To stand up right on the scene, so it's not a matter of kind of counseling, but rather material capacity to respond, you're saying.
I'm not downplaying counseling. Certainly, individual and even collective trauma are real, and they often, even usually, need to be addressed with counseling. But material preparation goes a long way towards giving people a sense of control an actual control over the conditions of their lives.
Phil is calling from Queens in New York. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Very well.
Two things I want to say. First, I wanted to say that I think most Americans and most Brits are not afraid. And part of it may be denial. You know, nobody wants to die. But
right.
Quite frankly, we're of tough stock. You know, our fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers fought in World War I and World War II and lived through the Depression and fought in Vietnam. We've lived through snowstorms. We've lived through relatives dying of cancer and heart attacks and AIDS. Look how the people in Southeast Asia are rebuilding after a tsunami that killed 175,000, 200,000 people. There is a natural resiliency in human beings. And if these two-bit terrorists and murderers think that they're going to scare us, even if they blew up New York, America and the West and modernity would go on.
I hear exactly what you're saying, Phil. I hear it exactly, and who doesn't respond to that and see the fact in it? But let me ask you, how did you feel on September 12th, 2001? Did you feel that?
I was a FEMA-trained responder.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands of men and women came down to Ground Zero,
mm-hmm.
and some with police units, fire units, emergency rescue units, but people just came down as volunteers to give water to firemen, to help people, you know, people respond, whether it's a snowstorm or a disaster. Every New Yorker has been stuck in a train. Every New Yorker, you know, goes through a tunnel even before terrorists. You know, what would happen if the tunnel collapsed?
And you saw that toughness on 9/11. We heard it again from Tony Blair in the U.K., on the very day of London's terrorist attack, saying we will not change our values under this kind of attack. Phil, thanks for your call. Jeff Greenberg, how do you interpret that? There is an innate resilience, obviously, in humans. They've stuck around this planet for a long time, and yet these are a different kind of attack than we're accustomed to. You know, to what extent can we count on that resilience? To what extent is that the is that is I don't know psychologically is that the place to turn to say we'll tough this out?
Yeah, well, I think Phil is largely correct. I don't think you can do that much in anticipation of these things to make people resilient. I think that yes, our species has a lot of built-in resilience, and you saw after 9/11 the way people responded. And even out here in Tucson, which is pretty remote from New York,
yep.
people were lined up. I went to go give blood. They said, we'll come back in 4 or 5 days, and we might be able to take you.
Wow, the line's that long.
Yes, so people responded all over the country. And what people want to do in the face of these kinds of deep threats is they want to feel like they can do something. They want to feel like they can contribute to some kind of heroic renewal and restoration of a sense that things can be okay again. And so a lot of that's really good. I think the problem comes in when another part of our response is to get angry and to want retribution.
And is that a positive or a negative or both?
Well, it can feel good individually, but again, it can lead us to strike out in the wrong ways. And of course, after 9/11, I actually thought that our country did a pretty good job of not turning its wrath toward American Muslims too badly. But mm-hmm. there were hundreds and hundreds of incidents, including murder, of people who simply looked like they might be Muslim.
And what's your sense of societies that deal with terror threats for long periods, where Israel or elsewhere, of the kind of impact it leaves? Okay, granted, that tenacity is there, the resilience is there, and yet there's nuance within that as this goes on over years. Does it produce healthier, stronger societies? Does it push minds and psyches in a particular direction?
Well, I think it does create a level of habituation. I mean, you have to think that's the case in Israel. In Israel, most people know somebody who has been hurt or killed in a suicide attack, and yet they go on living day to day. If you go there, people go to work, and they do what they have to do. They have certain security measures that they try to use, but they also understand that with suicide bombing, you're not going to be 100% safe. And they do learn to live with that, just as we all learn to live with the existence of cancer and heart disease and car fatalities. So there is a large... you know, it may be the case that as these events occur more and more, if they occur more and more, we'll develop some habituation to that, but we'll also continually want to strike out at what we think are the sources of these evils. And sometimes those striking out will be accurate, and will be well directed, and other times it won't be. And I think we can see that in the political policies of Israel as well as the United States.
Lee Clark, Jeff Greenberg, Jack Beatty, stand by. We have to take a short break here. We want to get your response, Lee, when we come back. We're talking tonight about the psychology of terror, how societies respond to man-made disaster. You can join us. Are we becoming inured to the terror threat? Is that good or bad? And can a society adapt in such a way that it becomes less vulnerable, even invulnerable, to the trauma of terror? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the psychology of terror, how societies respond to man-made disaster. You can join us tonight. Can you feel a difference between your personal response and American society's response as you perceive it? How do you see terrorism's long-term imprint on this country, on this culture, shaping up? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty's with us tonight, and we're joined from New Brunswick, New Jersey, by Lee Clark, sociologist at Rutgers University, author of the forthcoming book, Worst Cases. We're joined now as well from Tucson, Arizona, by Jeff Greenberg. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of Arizona. He's co-author of In the Wake of 9/11, The Psychology of Terror. Jeff Greenberg, thank you for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
I wonder your thoughts. You wrote soon after 9/11 about its impact. Now, here we are some time later. You wrote about how terrorism is a brutal reminder of life's fragility, and that has many implications for individual and social psychology. How do you see the American response over time shaping up in psychological terms?
What terrorism is ultimately about is dealing out death, and that resonates with the sense of vulnerability that we all carry with us. As Lee pointed out, terrorism and disaster is just one kind of threat that we have in society. I mean, there's cancer, there's homicide, there's car fatalities. And we have to cope with the reality, the knowledge of all of these possible threats. And I believe Lee is correct that before 9/11, Americans didn't think too much about terrorism as a deep source of personal threat. Since 9/11, we do think of it that way. And I think it has become another kind of threat that we have to find ways to cope with.
And do you see it changing, Americans as individuals, America as a culture, or are we just somehow taking it on board within the context that we carried before 9/11 in psychological terms? Do you see a deep imprint here or not?
Well, I think there was definitely a deeper imprint from 9/11. That's quite clear when you think about the Patriot Act, when you think about the military actions in Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq. All of these things are, in large part, long-term consequences of the attacks of 9/11.
Let me just ask you there: do you see those as strategic responses, or do you interpret those as psychological responses somehow?
Well, I think they're both. I think that a lot of the support for them among kind of everyday people is because it's psychologically comforting. That when we feel that we're under threat, we want to feel that there's something we can do about it, and we want to find these sources of evil, these things that are scaring us, and try to eradicate them. And so we look to our leaders to find answers and. I think the simplest answer is to go on the offense and find the evildoers and try to get justice out of it. And I think that President Bush has very effectively sold that message to the American people. And in light of the London attacks, he just kind of reiterated that view.
Now, we know the debate over that in strategic terms. In psychological terms, how do you see that response? Is that a healthy response, a productive response?
Well, I think it serves the individual's psychological equanimity, but it can be at the cost of those whom we designate as sources of evil that are worth killing. So it's sort of the, you know, that's a political issue. It depends on whether you think the attacks on the Taliban and the invasion of Iraq, whether the people who were killed and damaged by those things were legitimate sources of the sorts of evils that we'd like to eradicate. I personally don't think so.
But psychology and politics riding very close there. I want to begin to bring our callers in. A lot of them want to join this conversation. Trina is calling from Rutherford, New Jersey. Trina, what do you know? What do you think?
Well, I'm sorry, it's Karina, but thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was actually in Manhattan during September 11th, so I guess I'm calling in as an urban dweller. I guess I have 2 points. One is that I think that a lot of people that have to deal with these terror attacks directly are forced to work through the stages of grieving. For example, I honestly felt after September 11th that a lot of America was heavily within denial, and that kind of couched their reaction to Afghanistan and to Iraq. And that might also explain Caro's comments about liberals wanting to give the terrorists hugs also. But my other point is that during the London terror attacks, the day afterwards, I have a lot of friends that I just know who were very upset by them. But at the same time, in my professional world, my work friends and the people that I know around me in my community, they were really not affected at all. And that really upset me, you know. Because
it upset you because you saw terror with them on 9/11, and now they weren't responding to what was in London, or why?
Well, I'm in a different career right now, so I'm not with the same people that I had been. But it upset me because I remembered the way London had reached out to the New Yorkers, and I didn't see that. I mean, granted, I'm not living in Manhattan right now, so perhaps there was a large outreach there. But in the New Jersey communities, which I know were really affected, some communities here lost quite a few people in September 11th. I didn't really see that kind of outreach, and I'm not sure if we're inoculated or if we are just, you know, callous Americans that didn't think about people on the other side of the pond.
Karina, we've got it. We appreciate your call. Lee Clark, what do you say to that observation? Karina wanted to see more response from the Americans around her to what happened in London. How do you interpret? You describe people responding in very fulsome way when they're right next to a disaster, diving into help almost without exception. Here across the pond, is it different?
Hi, my experience was different from Trina's. I saw not massive outpouring of grief, but I saw a lot of concern on the part of Americans. It matters. The body count matters. I hate to sound cold and calculating about it, but when we saw what could have been tens of thousands of people could have been killed in the World Trade Center, that affects people in a different way than I don't want to. Again, I don't want to sound cold, but more than 50 people die in airplane crashes nearly every day. So it's. My experience was different than Trina's, so I'm not disagreeing or countering what she said, but I saw more outpourings of sympathy than
but,
that.
But you're saying at the same time scale matters. We're not so shaken by what happened in London because it's not the same as if it had been, I don't know, a nuclear reactor somewhere and thousands or tens of thousands killed. I mean,
or a nuclear explosion in the heart of London. I think it would have been would have been different then.
Jack, my sense is that we're, for all kind of peripheral, I don't know, self-congratulation for dealing with this last week so well, it seems to me we're all still vulnerable to that overwhelming disaster that once again shakes our sense of fundamental security in the world.
There's no question about it. I mean, people who've looked at the Homeland Security Program, I mean, we've talked about it on our show, of the gaps in it, the gaps in chemical plants, nuclear plants, you know, the gaps in terms of looking at the cargoes coming into our ports, our subways. In all of these ways, we are probably not as vulnerable as before September 11th, but still nowhere near where you would think the public would have demanded we should be. And that's the part of it that puzzles me, that that the public hasn't demanded more of this, that somehow the magic of the phrase Homeland Security Department, a big bureaucracy that can't get out of its own way, has allayed the fears that and almost the politics of fear alleviation that I thought was going to just sweep the country. But I see now that there's been a kind of suburban detachment from it. This is something city dwellers have to worry about. This isn't going to bother me up here in rustic New Hampshire. And I do think there's that kind of opting out. And I think it's reflected in this vote today in the Senate, where every Republican member voted against this $1 billion for subways. And, you know, when you thought about it, very few of those senators represent areas that have subways.
So there's a very kind of careful parsing of where vulnerability lies and if is it my vulnerability or someone else's.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh. Kevin's calling from Boston. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a psychologist, and my specialty is psychological trauma. For the last 20 years, and I'd just like to hear from your guests what they think about the idea of municipalities and state and even federal government really developing plans and strategies for psychological resilience, much the way we do for developing emergency response programs and crisis management recovery systems.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. Lee Clark, let me turn to you. I know you use this phrase preemptive resilience, and I don't know if you see that in terms of psychological or logistical resilience.
Sure. First of all, let me say that I agree with all those criticisms that Jack just leveled against Department of Homeland Security and our inattentiveness to these major risks. What I think, to answer the caller's question or address it directly, is I think that psychological resilience will flow from being more prepared at the local level. Let me give you an example. We know that roughly 20% of Americans are in K through 12, roughly half the year.
Right.
If I live in central New Jersey, some of us have some reason to worry about a chemical attack or an attack on a chemical plant around here.
Mm-hmm.
Should something horrific like that happen, probably the best thing for everybody to do is to shelter in place. Okay, so I need to know as a parent that my kids are going to be safe.
Otherwise, you're going to be running to the school when you shouldn't be.
That's right, because another one of those patterns that you asked me about from disaster research is that people respond to disaster, including terror attacks, in terms of familial units. Now, what happens immediately in this kind of situation is that the first grade teacher becomes a first responder. Mm-hmm. We don't usually think of them in that way.
Not a fireman or a policeman, but the person who's on the scene when it happens.
The fact is that most, and this takes nothing away from the firefighters or the police. I like them. I think we need more training and more resources for them, all of that. But the fact is that most people who are going to die in a disaster die before those people, the official responders, get to the scene. That means if we prepare at the very local level, workplace, schools, faith-based organizations, if we prepare there, giving people the resources that they need to have some confidence that they do control their environment, that will give them that psychological resiliency that the caller asked about.
To stand up right on the scene, so it's not a matter of kind of counseling, but rather material capacity to respond, you're saying.
I'm not downplaying counseling. Certainly, individual and even collective trauma are real, and they often, even usually, need to be addressed with counseling. But material preparation goes a long way towards giving people a sense of control, an actual control over the conditions of their lives.
Phil is calling from Queens in New York. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Very well.
Two things I want to say. First, I wanted to say that I think most Americans and most Brits are not afraid. And part of it may be denial. You know, nobody wants to die. But
Right. Quite
frankly, we're of tough stock. You know, our fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers fought in World War I and World War II and lived through the Depression and fought in Vietnam. We've lived through snowstorms. We've lived through relatives dying of cancer and heart attacks and AIDS. Look how the people in Southeast Asia are rebuilding after a tsunami that killed 175,000, 200,000 people. There is a natural resiliency in human beings. And if these two-bit terrorists and murderers think that they're going to scare us, even if they blew up New York, America and the West and modernity would go on.
I hear exactly what you're saying, Phil. I hear it exactly, and who doesn't respond to that and see the fact in it? But let me ask you, how did you feel on September 12th, 2001? Did you feel
that? I was a FEMA-trained responder.
Mm-hmm.
thousands of men and women came down to ground zero,
mm-hmm.
and some with police units, fire units, emergency rescue units, but people just came down as volunteers to give water to firemen, to help people, you know, people respond, whether it's a snowstorm or a disaster. Every New Yorker has been stuck in a train. Every New Yorker, you know, goes through a tunnel even before terrorists. You know, what would happen if the tunnel collapsed?
And you saw that toughness on 9/11. We heard it again from Tony Blair in the U.K. On the very day of London's terrorist attack, saying, "We will not change our values under this kind of attack." Phil, thanks for your call. Jeff Greenberg, how do you interpret that? There is an innate resilience, obviously, in humans. They've stuck around this planet for a long time, and yet these are a different kind of attack than we're accustomed to. You know, to what extent can we count on that resilience? To what extent is that I don't know, psychologically, is that the place to turn to say, "We'll tough this out"?
Yeah, well, I think Phil is largely correct. I don't think you can do that much in anticipation of these things to make people resilient. I think that yes, our species has a lot of built-in resilience, and you saw after 9/11 the way people responded. And even out here in Tucson, which is pretty remote from New York,
yep.
people were lined up. I went to go give blood. They said, "We'll come back in 4 or 5 days, and we might be able to take you."
Wow, the line's that long.
Yes, so people responded all over the country. And what people want to do in the face of these kinds of deep threats is they want to feel like they can do something. They want to feel like they can contribute to some kind of heroic renewal and restoration of a sense that things can be okay again. And so a lot of that's really good. I think the problem comes in when another part of our response is to get angry and to want retribution.
And is that a positive or a negative or both?
Well, it can feel good individually, but again, it can lead us to strike out in the wrong ways. And of course, after 9/11, I actually thought that our country did a pretty good job of not turning its wrath toward American Muslims too badly. But mm-hmm. there were hundreds and hundreds of incidents, including murder, of people who simply looked like they might be Muslim.
And what's your sense of societies that deal with terror threats for long periods, where Israel or elsewhere, of the kind of impact it leaves? Okay, granted, that tenacity is there, the resilience is there, and yet there's nuance within that as this goes on over years. Does it produce healthier, stronger societies? Does it push minds and psyches in a particular direction?
Well, I think it does create a level of habituation. I mean, you have to think that's the case in Israel. In Israel, most people know somebody who has been hurt or killed in a suicide attack, and yet they go on living day to day. If you go there, people go to work, and they do what they have to do. They have certain security measures that they try to use, but they also understand that with suicide bombing, you're not going to be 100% safe. And they do learn to live with that, just as we all learn to live with the existence of cancer and heart disease and car fatalities. So there is a large... you know, it may be the case that as these events occur more and more, if they occur more and more, we'll develop some habituation to that, but we'll also continually want to strike out at what we think are the sources of these evils. And sometimes those striking out will be accurate and will be well directed, and other times it won't be. And I think we can see that in the political policies of Israel, as well as the United States.
Lee Clark, Jeff Greenberg, Jack Beatty, stand by. We have to take a short break here. We want to get your response, Lee, when we come back. We're talking tonight about the psychology of terror, how societies respond to man-made disaster. You can join us. Are we becoming inured to the terror threat? Is that good or bad? And can a society adapt in such a way that it becomes less vulnerable, even invulnerable, to the trauma of terror? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.